So I've been requested to continue relating some of the memories I have of when I was so fortunately engaged in Srila Prabhupada's service as his bodyguard. I think I got up to where Srila Prabhupada had come back to Bombay. So Srila Prabhupada in Ram Nomi of 1977, after having gone to Mayapur, he did a cross Maidan program, and as I related last time, from basically Janmashtami of 76, Prabhupada's digestion wasn't kind of functioning properly, and gradually he just diminished eating, and basically for the whole of 1977 he was just drinking. Some of the devotees, the immediate servants of Srila Prabhupada, managed to convince Srila Prabhupada to take some Complan and sometimes some Horlicks, like that. That was all Prabhupada was taking. So by the time Ram Nomi came, Srila Prabhupada was very, very weak. And but as it was the second, if I remember right, the Cross Maidan program, the first one had been such a tremendous success, and the second one in 1977, there were at least, I don't know, 15,000-20,000 people every night. It's huge popularity that Srila Prabhupada had attained, had become world famous like that. So we would carry Srila Prabhupada on his palanquin like a chair with four arms like that. And I used to do that, me and Akshaya, the bodyguards, that was our service. We would carry Srila Prabhupada onto the stage, onto the Vyasasan from the car like that, and then from the car we'd carry him back to the, from the Vyasasan we'd carry him back to the car after the program. But each way, I distinctly remember, because I was always behind Srila Prabhupada like that, Srila Prabhupada was like so weak, he couldn't even hold up his head. He had already become quite thin. And this went on, I can't remember how many nights, but I think it was at least a week, this Cross Maidan program. And Srila Prabhupada, you know, he would be like this. And then, but as soon as you'd get on the Vyasasan, just poof, and then he was just preaching like a, so powerfully, just like a lion guru, preaching from Lord Rishabdev's teachings, hogs, dogs, camels and asses, and he was just hammering the audience, bam, bam, bam. And we were so, I was so amazed that, you know, how Prabhupada would just totally transcend his bodily condition while being on the Vyasasan like that. There was this sheik that came and assisted the program. Prabhupada saw him sitting and had the devotees bring him on stage. We had every night some VIP guests, so Prabhupada had him sit right next to him on the one of the VIP sofas like that. And every night that sheik was coming, and I remember towards the end of the Cross Maidan program, you know, the media coverage was intense because we had all come, you know, basically it was most devotees from the Mayapur Vrindavan festival had like followed, not maybe the most, but many, there were many devotees. We were having huge Harinams in Bombay to advertise. And, but you know, so many thousands and thousands of Bombayites. And the media made a big thing. He has this Muslim Arab sheikh, you know, with his kaftan, his white and gold thing, probably from Saudi Arabia or something. And he got a death threat. But still he kept on coming. But we were given lattes from by the police with lead in one end, you know, really mean weapon. And we'd have them right against Prabhupada's Vyasasana at the back. We'd stand either side of his Vyasasana at the back, just in case that death threat would kind of, someone would try and do something. But nothing happened. The sheikh. Yeah. The sheikh. But he kept on coming. And Prabhupada, don't exactly remember, but I remember Prabhupada talking about it also during the lectures. I remember one evening I was taking Srila Prabhupada back to his car after the program, me and Akshaya Prabhu, and near the car Tribhuvanath Prabhu was kneeling with his arms folded like that and this blissful smile on his face. And Prabhupada lifted up his head and just beamed him one of his Vaikuntha smiles. And I remember I thought, oh, this devotee Prabhupada really likes. During that Cross Maidan program was when I got my second initiation. And together one very elderly gentleman, I think his name was Deolal Mulchan, something like that. He was this very pious Gujarati gentleman from Surat, if I remember right. And he was in his mid-90s. And he got first when I got my second like that. And he had been the chief of police of Lahore and before it became Pakistan. And I remember one evening in the darshan, because probably was on one of the last days where they had the initiation ceremony in the Cross Maidan Pandal like that. But I remember one evening at Prabhupada's in Prabhupada's room in Juhu, we were there, new devotees. I was getting my Gayatri. And Mr. Mahadevia was there, and some other devotees, like that, some other guests. Mr. Mahadevia was very, you know, kind of intimate friend of Srila Prabhupada's since the beginning of ISKCON in Bombay. And he was joking that he was asking, because he looked really old. So how old are you? Something, 95 or something, I can't remember exactly. So then he made a joke to Srila Prabhupada that he's old enough to be your father. And everybody laughed, but then Prabhupada said, yes, but spiritually he's just a child. So then Prabhupada went, I believe it was to Rishikesh. It was to Rishikesh at that time. He went to Bhubaneswar before Mayapur. So it was after the Cross Maidan program. Still, you know, Prabhupada's health was just deteriorating. And he himself suggested that he remembered from his past life like that, how he was, I mean, past, earlier years, how he had often gone to Rishikesh and how the Ganges water there is very good for the health. So I wasn't, I didn't accompany Srila Prabhupada on that journey. We just took him down to the train, and then I was again re-engaged by Saurabh for the marble works, because he had put me out for a while. But the devotee who had was doing that, he couldn't continue with the austerity of going into this very backward area of Rajasthan. So I did that until, you know, the opening, and even after a bit, actually I even continued after with the samadhi. But anyway, as a, you know, trained architect like that, I was doing, because I knew Srila Prabhupada, he really wanted that Juhu temple open, where he could assist the opening, because he had promised Radharas Bihari, when he had placed them in their, you know, asbestos roof little shack there. And then they were even, you know, that shack was demolished once, you know. And so I heard like that Srila Prabhupada had promised them that he would make them a beautiful temple if they could just be patient. And so Prabhupada, I noticed this. I heard also that Prabhupada was particularly attached to a few deities, amongst whom was Radharas Bihari. Radharas Bihari, you all know how beautiful they are. Also Landanishvar, Radha Landanishvar. But anyway, we were really working hard to try and get this temple ready as fast as possible. And it was extremely difficult. I remember once we went to see the Maharani of Jaipur, Saurabh and myself, and the Thakur of Makrana, Thakur Vijay Singh, and we got a 4 lakh loan from her, because the money wasn't coming fast enough from Los Angeles, from the BBT or whatever. And so we took this loan, and we had a, you know, 3 shifts, 8-hour shifts like that of workers, 24 hours a day, the work was going on. And I was submitting reports like this. I would go, and then from Bombay, take the train and the bus to Makrana, and then from Makrana I'd go to Vrindavan. Jai Jai Shishi Radha Gopinath Chiki Jai. Shri Shigo Nithan Shishi Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Ji Ki Jai. So I would go from Makrana to Vrindavan, and then I would submit the report to Srila Prabhupada, and I would spend a week or two continuing my bodyguard service, and then I'd go down to Bombay and do the round again like that. And I remember once in July or so, maybe June of 1977, I came in and I gave Tamal the report of the progress of the marble work like that. And I, you know, it was a file, and every marble piece was listed like that, and you know what was lacking. And then I went to take my bath, you know, after the bus from Jaipur to Vrindavan, it's dirty. And then I came to take my bodyguard service. And then Tamal came, he saw me there, he says, "Boy, you're really lucky." He said, "Prabhupada is so pleased with your service." And I really felt, you know, wow, it's my success of my life, having pleased my spiritual master. Because about three or four of my godbrothers kind of couldn't do that service. Some, I think two of them even actually blooped. Somehow or other went there and then just left. The one I replaced was Narendra. He had just got married to this Swedish girl. And then he was going to Makrana, and then he just disappeared. He was a nice devotee. Actually, he used to be one of the bodyguards in America. So then from July onwards, it became obvious that Srila Prabhupada would be leaving. And I remember we were doing 24-hour kirtans. And I remember many of Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers would come and see him. And those last, you know, 3-4 months, Srila Prabhupada became very, very ecstatic. He would like cry practically constantly. And he became like so humble. I remember, you know, I can understand Hindi. Mauritius, so many people understand Hindi. And then I was forced to, you know, take Hindi lessons to be able to negotiate for the marble supervision like that. So I would be listening to Prabhupada and his godbrothers, you know, Hindi, Sanskrit, Bengali, it's all a little similar. But I remember how Srila Prabhupada used to so humbly beg forgiveness from his godbrothers for any offense that they might have felt like that. And one of Srila Prabhupada's dearest friends was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji. And we were all in this mood where Srila Prabhupada would leave and very sober, serious kind of mood. But every time he would come, he would be so jolly and laughing and, you know, like the whole day we would be there, Srila Prabhupada would just be lying on his bed. And Krishnadas Babaji would come in and he would giggle and he would just, you know, hop on and sit cross-legged next to Prabhupada on the bed, and Prabhupada immediately, Babaji is there. He would have him, you know, the servants sit him up against cushions, and then they would just chat away and laugh away. Like, it was so wonderful to see this incredible friendship between these exalted saints. And I remember being struck by that, you know, how the rest of us were all kind of like lamenting and, you know, completely devastated actually. Wow, Prabhupada's going to leave us, you know. Are we going to survive spiritually kind of in a thing without him, you know? But how as soon as Babaji Maharaj would be there, that whole mood would just disappear. And they'd just be so ecstatically happy. And how I made me realize, you know, that actually Srila Prabhupada was totally transcendental to his conditioning. And I could really pick up that Srila Prabhupada was very, very kind of fed up with some of the deviations and, you know, bad behavior of his disciples, even of his leaders. And I remember all the GBC were called like this on two occasions, actually. One was in maybe early July or so, and that's when he gave the list of the Ritvik to, represent him for initiation. The 11. He had put originally 9, and then when Bhavananda came back, he had been released from prison. He was imprisoned, I think, for quite a while with the Mayapur devotees, 1 or 2 months after that incident where the Gundas attacked. And then Srila Prabhupada heard how, you know, the Bengal government is a communist government I don't know if still, but in that damn time, and they really wanted to, like, you know, make an example that these Westerners are, you know, to be, you know, stamped out like that. And they, basically, it was all politically arranged, what I heard, where they hired these gundas to do this attack on Mayapur. And there were bombs thrown, and, you know, Bhakti Raghava Maharaj, he lost his leg with one of those bombs. And but they were all, I mean, about maybe, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 devotees were arrested and taken to Krishnanaga and put in a jail there. And then, you know, every time they would be taken from the jail to the courtyard, they would be chained together with, can't remember whether it was hand or, I mean, I didn't see, but anyway, they were all chained together like this. But in the jail, and especially during the procession, because everybody, you know, was, that's like a political ploy, come in and see, just see, we have all these sadhus and they're all prisoners, all these Western Angreji so-called devotees for them. But Bhavananda very fearlessly would lead big kirtans. And when Srila Prabhupada heard this, he said, add him on the list. And then again, when Hamsadutta was, he corresponded, he was in Ceylon at that time, Sri Lanka, and he was he challenged this scientist, and there was an exchange of letters in the main newspaper down there. He challenged the scientist that, you know, make an egg that will hatch a chicken in your, you know. And then in the newspaper, the headline was that even a chicken is a better scientist than you, because you can't do that. And Srila Prabhupada was very pleased with it. He said, add him on the list. So it became 11 like that. So, but still the mood of Srila Prabhupada was that he would go. And I remember, you know, that having been right into that entourage and assisted the way these senior godbrothers of mine would politic, and, you know, I was actually in my heart saying, praying to Srila Prabhupada, we're not worthy that you stay and suffer like this for us. Please don't stay. I was praying like this. But they were all praying. And then the second time they came, I think it was in August or so, then they all designated Kirtananda as the spokesperson for the GBC body, and they all went, and they were just crying in front of Prabhupada. So Prabhupada asked, yes, what is it? So then Kirtananda Maharaj very tearfully begged Srila Prabhupada, please, to stay. And Prabhupada did this like huge yawn and sat up and said, all right, so if I stay, I have to eat, so bring some prasad. And Pishima was there. She was totally in anxiety. Pishima was like a double of Srila Prabhupada. Exact same face, features. She was a very exalted, saintly lady. So humble. She always used to carry around this little bottle of Ganges water. And wherever she would sit, she would sprinkle it, smear it, to like decontaminate. I've contaminated this place, you know. But she would also often like spray us, you know, just like blessing of Ganges water. And as soon as she heard Srila Prabhupada agreed to take some prasad immediately, she went to cook. And Srila Prabhupada ate like almost a feast. Kirtananda had just come from New Vrindavan and he had bought some extraordinary. I remember me as one of the bodyguards, we got some of that maha, extraordinary milk sweets. But But anyway, then it like miraculously Srila Prabhupada recovered. And we like all became enlivened, and then, you know, the GBC gradually, one by one, they went back to do their service. It seemed like Srila Prabhupada would stay. But then again, he kind of declined. And at that time, I remember Prabhupada gave the instruction that we could go and consult some astrologers to see what was in store in his destiny like that. And me and Saurabh, we went, you know, on one of our runs to Makrana like that. We asked the Thakur of Makrana, do you know any good astrologer? Prabhupada wants to know. The Thakur, he was from one of these very aristocratic families. He was the only direct descendant of Prithviraj Chauhan Singh, who was a very famous king of India in around 1100. He was the emperor of India, Delhi, and mainly based in Ajmer. He's that famous king. When his father died, the king of Saurashtra down in Gujarat there released the horse to claim the, you know, the horse to do the Ashwamedh, and the army following the horse like that to conquer. And Prithviraj Chauhan Singh was just 14 years old, and when he heard this, he became so angry. Just to get rid of his anger, he went into the jungle, and just with a sword he killed a tiger and a bear or something, I can't remember exactly, but he just had to get rid of his anger. And then he took his army and went and killed the king of Saurashtra, and he became, at a young age, he had Shrutida, he could shoot an arrow just by sound. And actually he was attacked by that first Persian invasion, Muhammad Ghor, I think his name was. And 17 times he repulsed him and then released him, because as Kshatriyas they had this etiquette, you know, okay, have another try, you know. And the 18th time Muhammad Ghor's soldiers managed to capture Prithviraj Chauhan Singh. And then when he was brought in chains like that in front of Muhammad Ghor, he said, well, you've won this time, congratulations. And Muhammad Ghor told him, well, I'm not as foolish as you that I'm going to let you go. So then Prithviraj Chauhan Singh said, oh, then you're no longer fit for me to talk to. I was treating you as an equal, you're king of Persia. And now I'll no longer say anything to you. And he just kept silent. And he just looked at him very defiantly. And then Muhammad Ghor said, you look down, you don't look at me like this. If you don't, I'll burn out your eyes. And he refused, so he got his eyes burned out. So then, one of his best friends was this very famous court poet and like Qatar historian, Qatarwala. And he got engaged like by Muhammad Ghor, who asked him to recount the history of the kings of this, the Ajmer kings. They're the Agni Vansha, the three royal lines that I've heard of, maybe there's more, Surya Vansh, Chandra Vansh, and Agni Vansh. But anyway, he was relating all the, you know, history of these kings, and when he got to Prithviraj, he mentioned that he's Shrutida, he can just shoot at any target by sound. And Muhammad Ghor was so envious that he had been defeated so many times, 11 times or 17 times, I can't remember exactly. So He said, I don't believe this. And then he said, well, make him, you know, show you. So they arranged an arena, and he had a thing constructed where he was way up, just in case, you know, he would be in the line of fire. And they put a goat like 100 meters away, and blind. So then the poet and the Prithvi Raj, they embraced, they chanted Lord's name like a goddess's name. And he recited a verse, the poet, which was giving the exact location, more or less, of Muhammad Gore, according to the cardinal, 10 cardinal directions, the inclination of, like, you know, the Venus, because Venus never goes up above a certain degree like that. And then they put the goat, and the goat was bleeding. And then Muhammad Gore's general said, so shoot. But he wouldn't shoot. And then Muhammad Gore says, why won't he shoot? And they gave him just a blunt arrow, just wood, no point like that. And then the poet went and asked, and then Prithviraj said, I'll only accept an order from my equal. So then Muhammad Gore had to shout down, so shoot! And he just whipped around and shot him right through the throat. And then they just hugged each other, chanted their deity's name, and stabbed each other to not fall at the hands of the Muslims. This poet, an amazing Kshatriya like this. So Thakur Vijay Singh was the direct descendant, and he was actually venerated by the other royal families in Rajasthan and whole of India. In Ajmer, they have a very famous college. It's called the Mayo College, where all the princes were sent. It was done by the British. The main building looks just like the building Victoria Memorial in Calcutta. Pure white marble, beautiful, extraordinary architecture. It's called Mayo College because the headmaster was this Lord Mayo. And the British had very intelligently befriended all the different rajas, and they would send their princes to this school. The Thakur took us to visit it because the architecture there is extraordinary. Each kingdom would like try and surpass, you know, the other kings by making this extraordinary miniature palace with the style of architecture of their kingdom for their princes. I remember seeing the photos of the princes going in the procession with the elephants and the army and all the servants. And then in the classroom, you know, two or three princes and servants fanning them on each side, servants at their feet, massaging their feet, and an English professor, you know, instructing them. Like, this is quite an extraordinary college. Huge campus. And, you know, each kingdom had a, like, huge campus just for their own castle like that. You have to drive around to visit it. I've got a slideshow of that, quite interesting architecture. But anyway, the Thakur, he told us, well, when we were in Mayo College, there are two Ramal Babas in Jaipur. And we would all the princelings and like that, princesses, they would all go and consult these Ramal Babas to know whether they'd pass the exams. And so we asked, what is Ramal? So he said, well, Ramal is a postgraduate science of Jyotish. I after that found out that in the Sanskrit University of Varanasi, you have to study Sanskrit for 12, Jyotish for 12 years, you get your Jyotish degree, and then it's another 12 years of study to become degreed in Ramal. And Ramal, basically you go and see a Ramal Baba, you don't tell him your question. He takes your name, he takes the day and time that you've come, Then he takes, I think it was about 6 or 8 dice on a pin, and you have to rub it like that and throw it down. And then he calculates. He calculates for about 10 minutes like that on a slate. And then he tells you your question, and he gives you the answer. It's amazing science. So there was this one Ramal Baba, he was... He had a Goshala, his name was Jagdish Prasad Sharma. And he was this very sattvic Brahmin. He had a dungeon under his Goshala, just opposite the Lake Palace on the way to Amber, outside of Jaipur. And for 35 years he had been living just on the milk of his cows. He took half a liter of milk in the morning, yogurt in the morning, and half a liter of milk in the night, and that was it. Didn't eat anything else. And so we came, and Surab was the representative, and Thakur was translating from the Hindi to English. So he started calculating on his slate, and then he said, you have 3 questions. He said, the first, you're very concerned about finishing one work that's imperative and whether you'll be able to finish it. And then he said, the second, you're concerned about the health of an elderly person who's very, very important to you. And then he said, the third, you doubt, this is your inner question, you doubt whether Krishna actually exists. So Surab had just been made a sannyas, because his wife Kashori had a child with one Indian devotee, so Surab was more or less during the Mayapur festival, 1977, Prabhupada more or less forced him to become a sannyasi. He wasn't too happy about that. I was part of the construction office. I remember him kind of complaining, you can't say no to Prabhupada, you know, but I'm really not qualified for this. But anyway, he was a little embarrassed because he's a sannyasi, I'm his brahmachari assistant. So he just told the Ramal Baba, the Panditji, that just tell us for the second, please. And then he continued calculating. And now I'm sitting right, you know, opposite him like this, and I'm watching his face, and I'm seeing how Prabhupada is being revealed to him just through his calculations. And he became like real excited. He was saying, you know, this person, his books is read all over the world. He's Shakta Veshavatar. He's been sent to... And then he just interrupted himself, and he started asking the Thakur in Hindi, who is this person? No need to say, we all went from Vrindavan temple to see the Baba after that. And what he said, everything he said, actually he was one of the only ones, him and the other one that we met in Jaipur, they both said November. They were both the only, and other devotees had gone to Oja and to Moraji Desai's astrologer and so many other big astrologers, and they just gave so many different speculative things. One thing Srila Prabhupada had was that every 11 years, something major happened in his life. I remember that from the chart readings. So, I remember also the thing that Srila Prabhupada was being afflicted by. I mean, the planet was Shani, Saturn. So, one of the big astrologers said to wear a blue sapphire of, you know, it was about 10 or 12 carats or something. And Guru Kripa immediately brought one from Japan, you know, this from Thailand or somewhere. This huge, perfectly pure blue sapphire. And Srila Prabhupada wore it to the end. Actually, it's in the Samadhi with Srila Prabhupada on his finger still. Remember, it cost something like $5,000. Very valuable gem. Anyway, but Srila Prabhupada, I could really pick up, you know, he just wanted to go back to Krishna. He had done his you know, what he could. And again, he just stopped eating. I remember once, because he couldn't digest anything, and Prabhupada hated it when he couldn't digest. He had to go to the toilet like that all the time. I remember also, that was early on when Tamal and some others were trying to, almost we can say, curse Srila Prabhupada, you know, to eat something. And Prabhupada had kind of got a little angry, and he said, since my early life I have managed to give up sleeping, but I could never control my tongue, Prabhupada said like that. He said, now by Krishna's mercy I have no more desire, so you must respect my desire. I'm very happy to have been able to give up this eating business also. And but still Srila Prabhupada was kind of suffering. There's that incident where, that was right at the end, I'll come to that, but Prabhupada had a dream where he saw this Kaviraj with the Ramanuja Tilak, you know, big white and red in the middle, and that this Kaviraj would, you know, cure him like that, or heal, you know, heal him. So the devotees went around India, and they finally found this Kaviraj in Calcutta. He was a famous Ayurvedic physician there, and when he heard it was Prabhupada, he agreed to come and consult Prabhupada. And then he came, and he was giving these treatments. He stopped some others, because different people were trying to suggest different cures like that. Prabhupada also had a godbrother of a disciple of Keshav Maharaj, who was coming. I think his name was Sukhananda Brahmachari, if I remember right. And in Mula Prakriti's book, I was happy to read, he relates how, you know, in the earlier days, Srila Prabhupada had written a book in Bengali on water therapy, just using Ganges water, hot and cold. And he called, because he, Sukhananda had learned this from Srila Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada had called for him in those last days. And he was coming and he was doing this therapy for Srila Prabhupada. And like this. But anyway, this Kaviraj came, and you could see he was a very aristocratic, orthodox Brahmin family, Kaviraj. Not too favorably inclined, especially towards the Western devotees like that. I remember something, he came and then he went, but he came back and he stayed till the end. And I remember towards the end, he kind of underwent a change of heart like this, and he said, you know, I had my doubts about your Guru Maharaj, but now I realize he's a real saint. He said, I've treated thousands of people in this condition where the digestion, the liver and everything stops functioning, and then they wither away and become just skin and bones. And he said, generally in this condition I have to administer morphine because there's no longer any flesh or fat to cushion the bone from being pressed right against the nerve from being pressed right against the bone. And generally these people, you know, scream in pain until I just morphine and calm them like that. But he said, your Guru Maharaj, I've seen him for the last month and a half like this, and he never manifests the least pain or bodily discomfort in his facial expression. And he said, I can understand that he's a real saint like that. And he was kind of, Bhakti Churu told us this, they were both talking in Bengali. And he was saying, yes, I appreciate your Guru Maharaj as a real sadhu, Bhakta sadhu. Then I was there right up to the, I had done one Oh, I should stop. Huh? I had... Anyway, so just I'd like to relate one last thing. I was there right up to the day before Srila Prabhupada left. I had been postponing one of my rounds between Bombay, Makrana and Vrindavan for 2 weeks because it was evident that Srila Prabhupada would leave. During that time was when Prabhupada wanted to go on the last days, actually, just a few days before he left, he wanted to go on parikram on a bullock cart with Lokanath Maharaj around Govardhan. And it all got arranged, you know, and then again, Tamal and some others just went and they just cried, Srila Prabhupada, because the Kaviraj said, yes, it's all right, he's going to leave anyway. It's a matter of days. So if he wants to leave doing that, he had no objection, but that would kill him. The jolting of the bullock cart. So then they managed. And then Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji, he was the one, Prabhupada wasn't, you know, relenting. He was going. Lokanath made the arrangements, the chariot was ready, you know, bullock cart, everything. They had put, you know, so many mattresses so there would be really like least possible jolting. But then Krishnadas Babaji Maharaj, he said, just circumambulate the temple because Giriraj is there at the feet of Krishna Balaram. There's a Giriraj, Krishna Balaram, Shilas are there. So your desire will be satisfied. So then Prabhupada accepted and we did three rounds. It was one on the last days. But anyway, on the Sunday, I booked a ticket on the AC chair car and went down to Bombay. Got there on Sunday night. No, I got there, it was Sunday night, and I got there on Monday afternoon. And during that night, Siddhartha Prabhu and me were sleeping in the Brahmachari Ashram in the same room. Around 2 in the morning, he wakes me up and he says, Prabhupada is in the room. So just instinctively, from in my sleeping bag, I offered my obeisance. And I said, what do you mean, Prabhupada? I just left Prabhupada in the room. Then he like rubbed his head, oh, must be dreaming. And then we tried to take rest again, and the next thing, the storm hit us. And just outside the Brahmachari Ashram, there was this huge tamal tree, very old. When I was every time Prabhupada was in Bombay, I would be sent up to the top of the tree to pick the tender neem leaves to make Prabhupada's pakoras. And you know, the next thing, we woken up by this crashing tree, you know, wham! Against the building like that and on the ground. And then I remember the next morning at Mangalatik, we were informed that Prabhupada had left at about 7:15 the evening before. So we immediately went down to the station, went to the Vrindavan for the Samadhi Serum. And I remember that one devotee had bought the Times of India, like one of the main newspapers in India, and on the cover they had this photo of a tidal wave in Madras with flames on top of the tidal wave. Scientists are baffled how fire can be on top of a tidal wave. You know, freak storm sweeps through India. That storm just swept through, you know, the whole of India like that. And we were sitting in the train talking and saying how inauspicious it is when the pure devotee leaves the planet like that. These extraordinary symptoms. And I remember Siddhartha Prabhu telling me, Prabhupada came to take his neem tree. That's where I saw him, he was there, and then the neem went also. He was a barber before, you know, now he's head pujari since so many years, and he was a candidate for sannyas. Now he speaks good English, but in those days it was like... Anyway, there you go. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you very much.